You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Thursday, 17 April. We've got Fed balance sheet data late tonight. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, Metete Tulari from RNB. I want to chat on the rand. How much is the worries around the GNU and the DA and ANC kind of holding it back? If that resolves itself, can we see a stronger rand? Because dollar has been weak. Meryl Pick from Old Mutual Investment Group on the not-so-wild idea that gold could reach $4,500. Thoughts for me on qualifications you need to get into the investment industry. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more global opportunities through their partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management. Morning headlines, MoneyWeb. City of Joburg faces renewed power cut threats as Eskom debt dispute resurfaces following months of stalled negotiations and a delayed independent report intended to resolve metering and billing disagreements. News 24, lawyers and estate agents still threaten SA's efforts to escape grey listing, says the FIC. These are the last two boxes we need to tick by June. Morning markets, the US was red, S&P down 2.25%, NASDAQ off 3%, the 10-year a couple of points lower, 4.314%. The East is green, Sydney 0.8% higher, Tokyo up 0.9%, Hong Kong 1.6% higher, and Tencent up 2.2%. Commodities mostly green, gold futures 3,356, Brent 66.44, platinum 974, palladium is the red 965. The rand is 1884, Bitcoin 83,800. Top 40 opening call, green open at 290 points or a third of a percent higher.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Training now with Metete Tulari, head FX execution at RMB. Metete, we're seeing dollar weakness, and we can see that most notably in the dollar index, although that is mostly dominated by dollar euro. But nonetheless, we're seeing some dollar weakness. Our rand, however, crashed out. It's now back below the 19 level. How much is concerns around our government of national unity, the ANC and DA managing to find each other and stay friends, perhaps holding up the rand? We'll put it the other way. If we get a successful conclusion and everyone stays in and is still friends, do we suddenly see some strengthening in the rand?
Yeah, good morning, Simon. I mean, the rand came in within a whisker of breaching 20 against the dollar last week Wednesday. Obviously, as you know, escalating global trade tensions and the mounting political uncertainty here at home really did see the market shunning away from the currency in favor of physical assets such as gold. But you know, if you think about it, I mean, the market has been burnt by Ramaphosa and by the promise of the government of national unity. Now, I think the market is no longer taking SA at its word. And I think it's a wait and see approach whilst the GNU partners fight it out. I mean, despite the excitement and euphoria that we experienced last year post to the elections, you know, I don't think the market will fall into the trap again. I mean, if you just look at, you know, the government of national unity's wobble during that budget vote, you did see the bonds weaken quite significantly. You know, the 2030 bonds and also the longer end bonds also weakened quite significantly. More concerning, obviously, was the longer dated bonds that weakened quite substantially, which obviously indicates higher borrowing costs for the government for an extended period. Now, I don't think the market was really anticipating, you know, this budget vote to do what it did over the past couple of weeks. And now the news during the rounds is that the ANC may have to backtrack on the VAT increase as support from other smaller parties is waning. And I think that is also, you know, to some extent also may probably help the currency. But, you know, these political ructions that we're happening, you know, they're happening at the same time as the US tariffs, which means that, you know, SA assets, bonds, the currency are performing slightly worse than they normally would. Now, you know, the global markets have been really rattled by the latest salvo in this US-China trade war, which is intensifying fears of a full-scale economic war between the two world's largest economies. And now also you have, the presidency, now implementing, Mr. Jonas, Mr. Jonas to be an envoy to the U.S. That will also now be quite interesting, because also that means that the ambassador role is still also open. Now, does that mean also that the government of national unity partners need to have a say in all of these things? So at this point in time, there's so much that from a local front that we're looking at. But nonetheless, I think the market at this point in time is really being driven by what happens offshore, most probably 70%, and the other 30% being what happens locally on the local front.
Yeah, I take that point, and you said it before. It is there's stuff that we control, and then of course there is also sometimes the rest of the world. But there has been, I suppose, a sense of, and in some senses, we've had it twice where Ramaphosa perhaps has let us down. Motete Tulare, head FX execution R&B. Appreciate the early morning. Give you money, smoother returns for Stanlib Asset Management. The Stanlib Flexible Income Fund's agile investment process preserves and grows capital in all markets.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Meryl Peck, head of equities research at Old Mutual Investment Group. Meryl, appreciate the time today. You make a point in a recent note that in the post-Nixon era, and of course Nixon was the one who essentially scrapped Bretton Woods, took the US off the gold standard in 72, that there have only been two bigger moves in the gold price. That was 2001 and 2008. Both clearly crises. I suppose the question is, are we kind of in a crisis now? Because gold is kind of responding that it is.
Absolutely, Simon. The momentum behind gold does indicate the level of fear and uncertainty and investor anxiety that one would see during a crisis. We've looked at trough to peak moves in the dollar per ounce gold price from 1971 to now. Clearly, it's a very volatile metal, so we've excluded moves smaller than 20%, which for any other asset sounds crazy, but if you don't do that, then the data becomes very noisy. When you exclude moves larger than 20%, then this pattern starts to emerge. And the gold price troughed this time in September 2022 at around $1,635 an ounce. And we have just now exceeded double that value. I think last year, the idea of gold hitting above $2,000 again, seemed quite a substantial move. And today we stand in excess of $3,000. So these numbers sound big, but I think when you look at it in the context of the delta change, it puts more of that context. So in 2001, the gold price actually troughed in April at $256 an ounce, and it peaked 5 years later in 2006 at $725. So much lower absolute numbers than now, but actually that represented a move of 182%, close to triple the gold price, right? And then in 2008, something similar. In October, the price hit a low of $712 per ounce, and it went on to peak in September 2011 at $1,895. So over 3 years, more than double, 166%. So it just shows you how strong these rallies can be when the investment demand is strong enough.
And if we then take those numbers and extrapolate it out and put it into the current gold price, we kind of get to 4,500, which is about the craziest thing I've said all week. And in fact, Goldman Sachs said it earlier in the week, although they did say, and I stress, could plausibly, let's be clear here, but that is possibly where gold is heading in the, I don't know, medium to short term.
Yeah, so the price moves that I've described, they took place over 3 years in one case and 5 years in another case. As we stand in April 2025, we are about 2.5 years in since the last substantial trough, which was 2022. So, this isn't a short-term move. We're already getting closer to that three-year mark. So it is something that is conceivable, let's say, over a five-year period of time. Now, would one place a low probability on that? Certainly, and I would have said at the beginning of the year, a very low probability. Given the events of March, though, I must say, there are some analysis pieces out there that are starting to draw parallels between Trump's policy action and Nixon in the 70s. We have had this very stable global world order with the US being the big military and economic power, unilateral power, and playing a sort of, one could argue, largely supportive role in terms of maintaining both peace and trying to tip the scales in the favor of developing nations with trade policies and that. And Trump certainly does seem to be taking the world order in a different direction, as, you know, Nixon did to the extreme in 1971 by shocking his trade partners by no longer backing up the dollar with gold. So I think a lot is going to depend on how these trade negotiations play out during the 90-day pause. My sense is it is very hard to put this genie back into the bottle. And even if the administration comes and says, oh, forget it, drop the tariffs, take everything back to what it was, reset. Wow. We cannot erase what has happened and the potential long-term damage to trust. So yes, if you extrapolate those percentage gains off that September 22 low, if we have the 2001 case, which played out over 5 years, you could see a high of $4,600 per ounce. If you see the 2008 case play out, you could see $4,350. So clearly averaging the two gets you somewhere to $4,300. So we certainly haven't been in a hurry to sell our gold holdings. We just think that the prevailing uncertainty and logically the implications of these tariffs on inflation and weaker growth are both very supportive for gold. Clearly, this was a much easier call to make a year ago when we actually decided to add to gold for our clients' funds when gold was around 2,200. Now we are starting to reach the top quartile of the biggest moves ever in gold. We are starting to touch that territory. So it's a harder decision to make now, but the prevailing uncertainty certainly explains it.
It just so happened earlier in the week, I was looking at I'm looking at locally listed gold miners. I was looking at their all-in sustained costs. I was looking at the average prices they got for their last reporting period. All-in sustained costs, sort of at the low end, is Pan at about $1,350. Goldfields, Anglo Gold, Ashanti, a little over $1,600. What struck me is the price they received was only around $2,200, $2,300. If gold just goes sideways for the rest of the year, they're kind of tripling their profits.
Exactly. Exactly. So if gold stays anywhere near these levels, I expect all of them to finish the calendar year with little to no debt, if not very rich cash balances. And they all have their different strategies in terms of how they are investing that cash. We've seen M&A activity both in goldfields and gold. And that M&A or greenfields expansion typically is investing in assets that would move them lower on the cost curve. So it would widen that margin that they're seeing to the gold price. Harmony Gold is the most interesting one now. They've got a copper mine, which would call for investment starting from next year, a copper mine in Australia, which would take 3 years to build. At some point, it seemed laughable, but at this point, they could actually potentially fund that themselves with increasingly lower amounts of debt, the longer the gold price stays, you know, where it is. So shareholders might not see a lot of that cash, which is a worry. But even the idea, if you're bullish on copper, that Harmony Gold could build a mid-tier small copper mine out of their own balance sheet is quite phenomenal. You wouldn't have said that was possible 2 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. We live in crazy times. I think that best sums up. And as you say, I mean, it might not quite be Nixon, but certainly there's a lack of trust. And I mean, Mark Carney has said it's not coming back. There was a EU official earlier in the week saying it's not coming back. We'll leave it there. Meryl Pick, Head of Equities Research at Old Mutual Investment Group. Always appreciate the insights.
That's our poll today, 4,500. Goldman Sachs said it on the weekend. They said that was their they said it was plausible. But there's an argument there for it. Do you think gold could get that high? That's our question today. LinkedIn and Twitter, have your vote, have your say. Give your money the return at once without taking a flight with the StanLib Global Select Fund, an offshore equity fund submanaged by JP Morgan Asset Management.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
So some, well, Friday thoughts on a Thursday, because there is no, well, there's a Friday tomorrow, but we won't be here. Qualifications to get into the investment industry, something I get asked quite very regularly. Folks, sometimes it's people at school starting careers, sometimes people changing careers. And, you know, the first question is, well, what degree do I need? BCom, CA, that's the route which most people take. They chartered accountants, maybe auditors, but there is a layer of regulatory qualifications that are needed specific to the industry, and that's perhaps the important point. And I, folks who have come through with without degrees or without maybe an engineering degree, you know, without the sort of more classic economics degree. The first port of call, perhaps, is the Registered Persons Exams, the RPEs. There's a whole bunch that we need to do. There's some that are voluntary. And these are things like, you know, how the market works, understanding compliance, understanding ethics, understanding bond markets or equity markets or crypto markets, as the case may be. So there is a bunch of them. They're about 3,000 Rand in exam. You can write them regularly through the year. And you, South African Institute of Financial Markets is where you get that information, saifm.co.za. And anyone can write them. You pays the monies, you pitch for the exam, and you are good to go. And I think they, particularly for folks getting into the industry, I think they're worth having, both for what you practically learn, but I think also just that looks impressive on the CV. It absolutely does. At some point, if you're wanting to get into managing money, then things get a little more complicated. You need RE 5 and 1, 5 first, 1 second. The way an FSP would be set up is that there is a key individual, and they will have the RE 5 and 1 exams. And then new people come in, write those exams, and essentially work under them for a couple of years, I suppose, kind of tutelage in a sense. And then eventually, after the time has passed, you qualify with those exams. And that is then, depending on your FSCA categorizations, I'm not going to go too deep down this rabbit hole, but you can be a Cat 1 person, where you can transact on behalf of a person, but only on instructions. Category 2, you can basically manage their money. Category 2A is hedge funds. We've now also got crypto into there, but that comes later down the road. And then the other sort of route, which is perhaps less about managing money but more about research and the like, is your chartered financial analyst. There are three levels: CFA 1, 2, and 3. By all accounts, a tough exam to write. By all accounts, very impressive when you qualify and get your CFA levels 1, 2, and 3. Fun fact: Narina Fisser was the local chair of the CFA Institute in South Africa for many years. So CFA, certainly worth considering if you want to get more into the research side, perhaps less around managing money. Although I know a lot of folks who have gone through and done their registered persons exams and their REs and their CFAs. Equally, I would say, but is to run a real world portfolio. It might be a small portfolio. It might not be hundreds of thousands or millions of rands. But if you want to get into research and investment ideas, the key thing is, what are your ideas like? And the best way to show your skills is with a real world portfolio. That's it for today. I was chatting with Tian Pan yesterday from Prescient China. China's response to the Trump tariffs, and it has been, it's been kind of very muted, very relaxed, no knee-jerk responses. Although Tian does say he expects if they keep their 5% GDP target, and they have, there is going to be stimulus required for the economy, and they are positioned accordingly. We asked you, who's winning the war between the two global superpowers so far? Just over half said China by a mile. A third said nobody wins. And the rest said the US is doing great. Have your say, have your vote, LinkedIn and Twitter. This podcast is brought to you by Stanlib Asset Management. Invest in more certainty to navigate volatile market conditions. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website in the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again Tuesday. Economic Outlook.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.